A famous psychologist once joked, if you talk to God, you're praying. If God talks to you, you have schizophrenia. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, hearing voices is no joke. But depending on how you look at it, there can be a thin line between mental illness and mysticism.
For years when I was a kid, I heard voices, and they were distinctly human. Nothing coherent, but definitely a sound that nobody else was hearing, and it was fairly loud. Chopped up syllables and sounds, and it would circle around you. Oh, it was very scary. I actually would hyperventilate sometimes just trying to handle it.
That's Charles Monroe Kane, our producer. He was about 10 or 11 when he first began hearing voices, and he was pretty sure this wasn't something he should tell anybody about. So he kept quiet until God got involved.
When I was around 13, I remember this because it was after puberty, and I remember this distinctly because there's a girl named Michelle that I really liked who lived down the street. Michelle invited me to her church summer camp for a week, and it's a very evangelical camp. And on the second night, they had a tent revival. I've never been to church before. I had no idea what a tent revival was. When I was there, all these people around me loudly were speaking in tongues. And when I heard it, it sounded like the voices in my head. So I stood up, and I was hearing the voices were flying in my head too, right? And I just started saying them. I started saying these things out loud, really loud, and the whole place was silent.
And then you were 13.
I was 13, and I stand up and start saying out loud these voices in my head. Well, this is discerned as a gift by the people in that place. And a guy says, come on down. So I come on down to the altar. I lay down. I become a Christian. But for a good 10 years of my life, I believed God was speaking to me. I heard God's voice, and I spoke that voice out loud to other people.
Did God ever, or the voices, ever begin to say things you could recognize?
Yeah,
words?
So
did you get messages?
What happened is, as my teen years went on, the sounds turned to syllables. And then the syllables turned to words. And the first word I heard for a good year was Chuck.
Your
over
name.
And over again, my name with a question mark. Chuck, Chuck, Chuck. I'd hear it all day. And I was like, why the question mark? What does God want? And then later, in my 20s, it became sentences.
What did God say?
There were verbs. He would say, Chuck, jump. Chuck, run. Chuck, listen. Chuck, speak. That was a lot. Chuck, speak. And I would be at a church service somewhere and say, God wants me to tell you something, you know, then I'd come out and I did that for many years. I can explain it all the way now, but at the time I thought God was talking to me and then I was able to talk in his voice to others. And many people in that church in a small town in Ohio, a very poor community, thought that God was, you know, speaking through me as well. And I became a very powerful child preacher and a very effective one. I raised a lot of money. I did a lot of things. And I told people to do things I thought God was telling them to do through me.
Chuck, hearing you say that now, you know, you and I work together, we're colleagues.
Yeah, you should be listening to me.
But just hearing you say that now, it's scary. And I also feel so sorry for that 13-year-old self.
I started taking medication about five years ago to more seriously deal with having hearing voices and my mental illness. And when I did, I said, I'm not going to be bitter about who I was. Did people use me? Yeah, I think they did. Some older people. Was I an egomaniac? Yeah, I was an egomaniac. If you're that kind of vessel for any period of time and really believe it, it can be very powerful. I felt God and I were like very close.
Do you miss it?
I miss it. I was just going to say, that's funny you asked that. Yes, it was beautiful. I mean, there would be many times, especially when I was alone, and when I would be sitting alone somewhere on a beach in another country or just at bed at night, and it would come on, and I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to have a conversation with God. I don't fully understand what he's saying. Why would you, right? It's God. But God's talking to me right now. There's a whole damn universe, and God's talking to me right now. It was beautiful.
Has it ever occurred to you, or have you ever been tempted to think that maybe the voices were both? I mean, yeah, maybe it's a mental illness. Maybe it's also God.
No. Schizophrenia and other mental illnesses have a direct connection and a direct work in your brain, and they've come up with fairly easy to take medications that don't have a lot of side effects to help you because it progresses. And as it progresses from sounds to syllables to words to sentences to commands, what's next? I have a fear. There's a man I fear, and I love this man, and I care about him, and I worry about him, and I see him a lot. And this man's on the streets, and he's muttering these weird syllables and sounds, and I recognize the syllables and sounds. But I always fear I'm going to be him. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm going to end up like that guy. I'm going to end up on the streets, have my cup out and be crazy because I am. And so it's not a gift. It sucks. It sucks. It's not a gift. And so I don't ever would want it on anybody. I don't ever want it back. And I just take my medicine and basically don't really deal with it anymore, except for the fact that I'm not going to look back at my young self and say I hate him for being confused. I mean, who wouldn't be confused? But at the same time, there are moments at night when I'm alone, you know, where I'm like, you know, I kind of miss, I don't know, talking to God, you know what I mean?
Well, we love who you are now.
Well, thank you.
Charles Monroe Cain left the church in his 20s. He's been a public radio producer on this show for more than a decade. And his story is our jumping-off point for thinking about mysticism and mental illness. Stanford anthropologist Tanya Lerman is interested in both. She's done participant observation work with evangelical Christians, and she's also done cross-cultural studies of schizophrenics who hear voices. She told Steve Paulson they are not at all the same, but they do have a few things in common.
So people who meet criteria for schizophrenia, for example, often have an array of auditory experiences. So they can hear murmurings, they can hear screeching, they'll talk about a voice jumping from one person to another person, and they hear voices. So they will say that they hear a voice that's outside of themselves and sometimes a voice that's inside of themselves. So I was curious about the question of whether this experience would be different in other parts of the world. And I did this with some of my colleagues in South Asia and in Ghana. We interviewed people here in the Bay Area, and I interviewed people in a psychiatric hospital in Ghana and in a psychiatric treatment program in Chennai, in South India. And the question was, what do people say that their voices say? And I was struck by the differences. We found that in the American setting, people hated their voices. Not one person said that their predominant experience was positive.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I assume they had been diagnosed as mentally ill.
All these people have been diagnosed with as mentally ill. Everybody's sitting in a hospital. They all carry a diagnosis of schizophrenia. They're all on medication. So in some basic way, they're all the same kind of person with the same kind of illness. But the voices in Ghana and in Chennai were more likable. And people sometimes liked them even if they didn't like what the voice was saying.
That's fascinating. So that, a totally different cultural take on whether these voices are damaging or not.
Well, not totally different. So everybody around the person agreed that they were ill. And the person themselves, they knew they had a problem. But they did sometimes say, you know, with all these problems, it's these voices that have kept me alive till now. Half the sample in Accra said that they heard God speaking. And God would tell them not to pay attention to their demonic experiences. In Chennai, people were more likely to hear their relatives. They might really think their relatives were very annoying, but their relatives told them not to drink, not to smoke. They told them to do all these chores. So there was a very different quality than this American experience. And so, you know, the American subjects that I spoke with, their identity had become the identity of somebody with schizophrenia, and that was different from the others. You know, there was they had no other good way of conceiving of their experiences except through a diagnostic lens.
Right.
Where that more of the folks in Accra and Chennai, they knew they had a problem. But the voices weren't always identified with a problem, and the voices sometimes helped them to cope with a problem.
Now, you wear a couple of hats in your work as an anthropologist. You also study religious experience, and you did a fascinating study of evangelical Christians where you spent 2 years as a participant observer. What were you trying to find out?
So I was really trying to find out the question, how does the immaterial or the divine or the supernatural, how does that become real to people? This is not the question of whether the supernatural is real or whether the divine is real. This is the question of how God becomes so real to people so that they experience God as standing by their side. The kind of church I went to would be called a charismatic evangelical church. People talk about God as talking to them, as interacting with them. They're saying things like, I recognize God's voice the way I recognize my mom's voice on the phone.
So God is sort of like your best friend, or maybe, mm-hmm. maybe more like your therapist, someone who's going to make you feel better.
All of those. You know, it wasn't as if people had auditory experiences all the time, and that was not what people thought of themselves as developing, although they sometimes did hear God speak in an audible voice. But it was more learning to pick out what you might have thought of as your own thoughts in your mind and coming to recognize that they might be God's thoughts. I mean, they were also pretty sophisticated about this. So, you know,
so these were not uneducated, illiterate people you're talking about here.
No, these are super educated, very skilled people, university trained people.
So how do they develop the skill of talking with God?
So if you're first looking for certain kinds of thoughts, you're looking for thoughts that pop out, that feel more spontaneous, that feel stronger than other thoughts, then they'll ask, okay, which of these thoughts is the kind of thing that God would say? You know, so one man said to me, there was this time when his parents were getting divorced, and I think he was something like, you know, 10 years old, and he was terribly upset, and he was in his bed at night, and he thought he heard a voice say, I am with you, something like that. And it was very powerful. It was very comforting. It felt very real to him. And he'd been talking to God for 3 decades by the time that I met him. And he said, you know, that one, I'm sure that was for real. Everything else might just be a mistake.
Well, one thing that's so fascinating about what you're saying is, I mean, there is a very intentional act of imagining going on here.
Yes.
And in fact, I mean, you write about the famous Christian writer C.S. Lewis, who had a chapter mm-hmm. in his book Mere Christianity called Let Us Pretend.
Mm-hmm.
What was he saying we should pretend about?
So he was saying you should pretend in order to experience as real. What I find fascinating about Lewis is that the use of the imagination to experience God has always been part of Christianity. I mean, God is immaterial. You need to use your capacity to represent images and words in order to pray, in order to represent what God is saying to you. So you're using your imagination. There's something that happened in the, you know, in the modern era that we came to think of imagination as something that was about falseness. And so...
Well, and it's also, it's what kids do. I mean, kids have imaginary right. friends, and then, you know, we're supposed to grow out of that and become rational, sensible adults.
Mm-hmm. But using the imagination to interact with God, to allow God to be imprinted in your inner world. And what I've found out is that this practice of using your imagination actually does help you to experience what you must imagine as being more real. It somehow comes alive to you.
Well, I mean, but then the question is, these evangelical Christians you were hanging out with, did they think of these encounters with God as real or as fictional?
Both. It seemed to me when I talked to people, I mean, people were very, very comfortable saying that God was real, God existed. But they were also talking to God about the little things. So they were asking God what shirt they should wear in the morning and getting an answer. They would go on dates with God. So mostly the women, but they would, you know, so you'd get somebody who would get one sandwich, go down to the, you know, the park bench and sit there in the park with God with his arm around her shoulders, and they're talking about the day. But the God that is really emphasized in these churches is a friend, a therapist, a pal, somebody who's always available, always has your best interests in the mind, you know, is kind of like a great big teddy bear.
Hmm. You ran an experiment, a psychological test to probe the power of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what you did?
So I got over 100 people into my office, and I'd made these exercises, and they were half an hour long, and they were sort of prayer-like experiences. Anyway, I randomized people into a group that would listen to those half-hour prayer-like experiences every day, or a group that was listening to half-hour lectures from the teaching company about the Gospels. And the rule was half an hour a day, 6 days a week for a month. And it turned out that the folks in the prayer condition were more likely to say that their mental images were more vivid. They were more likely to say that God had become more person-like, that they had a more playful relationship with God. They're also more likely to report these sort of odd, unusual, intense spiritual experiences, powerful rushes of emotion, a sense that God was near, tangibly present to you, almost as if you knew exactly where he was standing in the room.
Right. So you could basically teach yourself to become, well, more adept at communicating with God, having these powerful experiences.
Absolutely.
But I have to say, it also sounds like a recipe for possibly inviting the delusional into your life. I mean, if you keep imagining something is real and you're getting constant affirmation from people around you, it will become real in your mind, right?
Well, yes. Except that, you know, they had these vivid experiences of God, but they also had a pretty strong, what you might call a reality frame. So if they did feel that God was telling them to start a school or to, you know, move to Los Angeles, they were pretty good at checking in with other people to see if this made sense. You know, they could feel that God was telling them something, but they also always carried within the sense of questioning of whether that was really God or whether it was themselves.
Now, you've said that you participated in a lot of these activities. You joined prayer mm-hmm. groups. Did you have powerful experiences yourself during prayer?
I came to have experiences that I would describe as God speaking to me, and I would have this sense of, you know, a peace and a calm during prayer in some of these settings.
So it felt like you encountered God.
I do use that language.
You finished this study a few years ago. Do you still mm-hmm. pray?
I do something like praying, yes. So I've switched more recently to using mindfulness for various reasons. I thought it would be kind of an interesting thing to do. Mm-hmm. But I still have a spiritual practice.
Tanya Lerman is an anthropologist at Stanford University, and she's the author of When God Talks Back. She spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, the story of a medieval woman mystic who wandered all over Europe, annoying people, and David Steindl Rast on life in a Benedictine monastery. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
People think she's a whiner, she's a liar, she's a moaner, a kind of self-seeking attention whore is the phrase that one person used on Twitter. They regard her as a fake.
That's a lot of vitriol for a woman who lived more than 400 years ago. Marjorie Kemp was once one of the most famous Christian mystics in the world. She was a medieval pilgrim who walked across most of Europe and even to Jerusalem. She wrote a memoir considered the first autobiography in English. But both then and now, she irritated the hell out of people. The University of London medievalist Anthony Bale recently edited a new translation of the book of Marjorie Kemp. He says it's not only a gripping read, it also gives us a glimpse into everyday life in the Middle Ages.
She's an extremely provocative character. She was born probably in the 1370s, and she died around 1439. So she lived until quite an old age. She was from an English town called Lynn, and she was quite well born to quite a good family, and she had 14 children.
14.
She then had a kind of spiritual crisis and awakening where she put aside her marriage, her family, and she became a virgin.
That's a neat trick after 14 children.
She started wearing white clothes, which is a sign of her virginity. And she started having mystical conversations with God and with Jesus and with the Virgin Mary. And she devoted her life to spiritual conversation, how she describes it. And she basically traveled all over Europe as a pilgrim. And when she was quite an elderly lady in her 60s, she had her experiences written down in the book which I've been working on, the Book of Marjorie Kemp, which is often called the first autobiography in the English language. So it's quite a landmark publication in those terms.
But it must also surely be one of the first autobiographies of a woman.
Absolutely. So it's a very arresting document. Someone has sat down with Marjorie Kemp in the 1430s and written out her life. It was a story that was believed to be worth preserving and retelling.
Well, obviously, there's more to it than just the bare bones of her story. If
Absolutely.
She's still eliciting such strong reactions and still pissing people off even today, what was she like as a person?
We only have her account of herself to go on, but even then, she includes in her book many, many incidents which show her alienating the people around her and being very annoying. There's an incident early on where she is traveling to Jerusalem via Italy, and the pilgrims that she's traveling with, they ask her not to eat with her. So she eats alone for 6 weeks.
They ostracize her because she's so annoying. They don't want to have
so annoying.
They don't want to eat with her.
Because she won't stop talking about God. These people are a pilgrimage. They're supposed to be holy, but she's
enough
too much for
enough.
Them. And then later on, she receives what she calls the gift of tears, which is God-given weeping. And she can't stop. And this is obviously very annoying to the people around her, that she will suddenly burst into tears.
Do we know anything about what these tears from God would have been like? I mean, are you talking copious, hysterical, sobbing, very dramatic, or did tears just quietly trickle down her cheeks?
No, they were not quiet. They absolutely were not quiet. That's the one thing they weren't. She describes them in lots of detail. Her crying involves often falling to the ground, moving her body, kind of copious, gut-wrenching sobs and screaming. And she sometimes uses her crying to really make an intervention in company. You know, she will really gain the spotlight on her by suddenly bursting out crying.
Well, also, that kind of crying, it seems like today we'd just say she was hysterical and had some terrible need to be the center of attention, much like I think of certain contemporary celebrities. Do you think that about her? Do you think she was just attention-seeking and none of this was really real?
Not at all. I mean, what the very first people who wrote about Marjorie Kemp in the modern period, in the 1930s, when her book was rediscovered, they tended, as was the trend in the 20th century, to think of her in psychological terms. So the very first editor of her book said she was a neurotic. And other people have said that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis after all these children, that she was psychotic, or that she had frontal lobe epilepsy. So people have kind of tried to explain this through medicine. But actually, her crying is something that lots of medieval holy women do. And you might see it as a way that women in particular could express themselves, as women weren't allowed to preach in the church. She's weeping because God has given her these tears.
But I find this really fascinating, that tears can mean, even in a social context, you know, several hundred years ago, something different than what they do today.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess what you're talking about is, I know you're interested in the concept of emotional history.
Yeah.
I guess we maybe tend to assume that the emotions just are. They happen to us, and maybe we have some different words for describing them, but not that we maybe experienced emotions very differently than our long-ago ancestors did.
Absolutely. This is a development which has really taken off in historical and literary studies in the last 10 years or so. And people are now considering emotions very much as historically specific practices. You know,
for example?
Well, a very good example is when Kemp first sees Jerusalem. This is quite a kind of high point for her. She's traveled all the way from England to the Holy Land, and she arrives on a mountain where she glimpses a view of Jerusalem. She's riding on a donkey at this point. And if I can just read a few lines from it in the modern English, it says, "Then, when she saw Jerusalem, for the joy that she had and for the sweetness she felt in conversing with our Lord, she was on the verge of falling off her ass, for she could not bear the sweetness and grace that God performed in her soul." Now, what you have here is a kind of, that word joy that she uses, this is a very specific word, partly because the mountain that she's on is called Mount Joy.
Huh.
It's a mountain still there in the Holy Land. But this word joy, it's a very specific word in the Middle Ages, which doesn't mean happiness. Joy is a very hard emotion to get, and you don't have it for long. It's something which is very closely linked to its opposite, kind of woe or heartbreak or sadness. And joy is particularly associated with glimpsing God or being close to God.
That sounds like a kind of ecstasy.
It's not quite as high as ecstasy, but it's getting there. And joy is very hard won.
She's talking about a joy that's almost painful.
Absolutely, exactly. Extreme emotional outbursts, if you like, were a very definite part of Christianity. Hmm. That it was normal to weep, to scream, to do extremely ascetic things. You know, Marjorie Kemp wears a hair shirt made out of badger fur, and she goes without food at various points, and she walks huge distances. So to perform a kind of penance, suffering, emotional victimhood is a very common thing in this period, partly because it allows one to identify more closely with Christ.
Well, surely also because it allows one to escape your daily life.
Well, that's what pilgrimage does for Marjorie Kemp. She's able to go off to Spain, off to the Holy Land, off to Italy, off to Germany and Poland and Norway. And her mystical relationship with God actually allows her to...
The freedom of the Western world.
Yeah, to leave her husband, her children, two failed businesses. She talks about a failed attempt at brewing and a failed attempt at milling. So, yes, it allows her to escape some of those quite constricting roles.
So for people who are not medieval scholars, why read the Book of Marjorie Kemp today? What does it offer us?
Wow. I think it's really a very remarkable document about the shape of the medieval world. Kemp travels all the way from Spain to the Holy Land, to Scandinavia, through Europe. So it's really a kind of miniature encyclopedia of medieval life, which is extremely vivid. And I think there's also a very romantic and interesting story about its rediscovery, that it was really forgotten about from the 16th century to the 20th century. And then the manuscript was found in the cupboards of a country house in the north of England and literally hadn't been read for hundreds of years.
And it was found, that's a great story though, you have to tell it. It was found at a house party, right?
It was found at a house party, apparently as a group of people were playing table tennis or ping pong, and somebody stepped on the ball and they went in the cupboards to look for a new one, and out fell an old book. And it just so happened that one of the people at this party was a curator at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and he recognised that this was old and probably worth something, so he took it down to London. And by chance, an American independent scholar called Hope Emily Allen was in London at the time, and she was an expert on medieval mysticism, and she recognised that this was probably the Book of Marjorie Kemp that she'd heard about but had never read. And she devoted her life to studying it, actually. And it was published in 1940.
So Marjorie Kemp is irrepressible.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And it was really feminist scholars in the 80s and 90s who then allowed us to study her today and give us the tools and to understand her in the way that we can now.
Anthony Bale teaches medieval literature at the University of London, and he just came out with a new translation of the Book of Marjorie Kemp. So what is it like to be a practicing mystic today? Steve Paulson recently had a chance to ask the Benedictine monk David Steindl-Rast. He's a native of Vienna who joined a Benedictine monastery in New York in 1953. Brother David has written many books, and he was one of the first Roman Catholics to engage in dialogues between Christians and Buddhists. He still divides his time between writing, lecturing, and living as a hermit.
Brother David, you have said that religion always starts with mysticism. There's no other way to start a religion. Can you explain why mystical experience is central to what we come to call religion?
Well, if you take the very word religion, it might come from the Latin religare, which means tying again something that has been torn apart. And what is being tied again when religion does what it's supposed to do is the bonds between us and our genuine self and between us and that transcendent mystery with whom we are confronted in life. And when I say mystery, I mean that which we cannot grasp because it transcends intellectual concepts, but which we can understand by putting ourselves into it and letting ourselves be grasped by it.
What do you mean by grasp?
I think for most people, this is best illustrated by music, listening to music. We cannot grasp music intellectually. We can know a lot about who wrote it, what kind of instruments are playing it, and none of this will really make us understand what this piece of music really means. But we can let ourselves be touched by it. We stand in it. It runs over it like you stand in a shower. And mystic experience, most people experience it in what the psychologist Abraham Maslow calls peak experiences. Mm-hmm. In peak experiences, we are touched by a transcendent oneness, if only for a fleeting moment.
I want to ask you about your own personal history. You were born in Austria. You grew up during the Nazi occupation. When did you realize you wanted to become a Benedictine monk?
That was actually right after the war. During the war and during the Nazi period, we read all these religious books. And among other things, I read The Rule of St. Benedict. That is a tiny little book, dates back to the 6th century, and in it was a little sentence, and that said, to have death at all times before your eyes. And that moved me. That was in the middle of the war. My friends were dying left and right, either in the war, shot or killed by bombs and so forth. That moved me, and I kept it sort of in the back of my mind.
I would think maybe you wouldn't want to have death always before your eyes as you were witnessing the war.
We couldn't help it. And then the war was over, and it just never occurred to me that I could live to be 20. I wasn't 20 yet. I was 19, and the war was over. It was vacation time. I had music. We had very little to eat, but we were joyful. I had a girlfriend. I was in Salzburg. And suddenly it occurred to me that if I did not have death before my eyes, everything would be downhill. It occurred to me that we had been so happy and joyful because we were living in the present moment. And living in the present moment is the task of the monk. A Buddhist monk, Hindu monks, everybody will agree. Our ideal is to live in the present moment. So I knew I had to become a monk.
Has this been a hard life?
Well, I would say every human life is a hard life. Life is just hard.
But there are some things, and specifically about the monastic tradition. I mean, it's rigorous. It's austere.
Yes. If you are made for it, it's your kind of hard life. The hardness will also be something that you like. In fact, I had a most unusual monastic life because I really, really liked to be in the monastery and just that every day the same thing. That was my dream. I remember very well as a young monk, I was thinking ahead and I was thinking, well, 20 years from now, on Friday, the 15th of March in 1975, I know exactly what I will be doing. I know exactly what prayers I will be saying. I know exactly what time I will be getting up. that gave me such a joy, probably because I grew up in all this uncertainty of war time and so forth.
It doesn't get boring?
Not the slightest bit boring, on the contrary. And things that even other monks found boring, like, for instance, stuffing envelopes with letters that we sent out and things like that. I love that. Those were my favorite tasks. I was house cleaner. So I was just from morning to night, all our working hours, and every day we work with our hands, that part of our life. I was just sweeping the floor. And just the way the dustpan sounded when you hit it with the broom, this sort of thing was ecstatic for me. I really liked that. And from then on, I traveled a great deal. And because I traveled at least half the year, my abbot said, well, when you come back, you see so many people as you're out there, you need a little more solitude. And I got permission to live as a hermit. So it was a very unusual life for a Benedictine monk.
Do you like that kind of solitude?
Yes, I like that. Right now, it has become a little too difficult for me. During my last years, I was in a hermitage in Switzerland, in the mountains, just to carry the wood in and chop the wood, maybe. But being alone, it got a little dangerous in winter and so forth.
And how old are you now?
I'm 89 this year.
Now, you have met many people over the years, of course. One was Thomas Merton, the famous Trappist monk. Did he have a big influence on you?
Yes, it did have an influence, because this was just at the time when a certain rapprochement took place between Catholic monks and Buddhist monks. And we met at that time, and he had contact with, for instance, Thich Nhat Hanh, which I did too. Both of us had independently contact with Thich Nhat Hanh. But his contacts were more intellectual, and I had not studied nearly as much about Buddhism, but I was already in a zendo and practicing. So he was very interested in that aspect, and I was interested in what he had to tell me. So it was a very fruitful mutual inspiration, I would say.
Now, you were studying in a zendo, but you were a Benedictine monk. Why were you in a zendo?
Well, at that time, these other monks were appearing. You see, I was sent out to New York to give a talk and go back to the Benedictine monastery. And there I meet a Buddhist monk, and I meet a Hindu Swami running around. That was the first time that we saw this in the West.
Did that enrich your spiritual practice? I mean, once you started having these interfaith contacts, I mean, especially with Buddhists, but I know with other spiritual traditions as well. I mean, did that make you a better Catholic?
Yes, it did deepen my relationship to that great mystery that we call God. We have in the Catholic tradition what we call the prayer of silence, and we practice it a lot in the monastery. Zazen cannot be distinguished from it, but the Buddhist monks is the same. They call it differently, in a different conceptual structure, but basically you let yourself down in that mystery.
And yet the Buddhists say there is no God, in their tradition at least.
Yes, and when I talked with my Zen teacher, I would assiduously avoid the word God, of course, just out of respect. And after a very short time, he would always use the word God. And that was surprising to me. And once he said, which is also very insightful, he said, you know, we avoid the word God because when you speak about God, it sounds as if you were talking about God from the side, he said, like in profile. You can only talk to God face to face, he said. And that's such a profound Christian statement, you know. You can't talk about God in the third person. It's always a first person thing. So what I understand about our Christian faith is very much influenced by my experience of Buddhism.
That's David Steindl-Rast talking with Steve Paulson. Brother David has been a monk at the Mount Saviour Benedictine Monastery in New York since 1953. Coming up, the nighttime world of demons and sleep paralysis. I'm Anne Strange-Shamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Getting a good night's sleep is hard for a lot of people, but imagine trying to drift off when you know that you're likely to have terrifying nighttime hallucinations. That's the world Rodney Asher explores in a documentary film called The Nightmare. It's about a condition called sleep paralysis. People who have this condition can't move, speak, or react when they're falling asleep or waking up, and some of them even have visions of demonic shadow men that hover over them in bed. Doug Gordon talked with Asher about this unsettling experience.
Rodney, why did you want to make a documentary about sleep paralysis?
Well, I mean, it's a subject I've been interested in ever since it happened to me. Coming from my last film, Room 237, which was, you know, a documentary about a horror movie, it seemed like sort of an interesting progression to make a documentary that in some ways was a horror movie and to bring to life these experiences for people that are akin to horror movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned you've had your own personal experience with sleep paralysis. Can you tell me about it?
Mine was, I don't know, what I would almost call a classic sleep paralysis experience. You know, I woke up in the middle of the night. I wasn't able to move. I didn't understand why, and I was scared. I might have started to panic. And I wanted to call out for help. I lived in a house with a few roommates, and I couldn't make a sound. I sensed that there was something outside of the house, kind of outside of the window, looking in at me. And after a minute, it was in the room, and it was one of these, they call them shadow people. Looked like a very cleanly described silhouette of a person, of a man, who kind of looked at me and just walked very, very slowly towards me and leaned right over my face. I kind of associated the paralysis with this presence, almost as if it had a superpower to keep me immobilized. I tried to move and I tried to scream, and I think it almost felt like, you know, time stopped. I just struggled for a few minutes. I kind of lost track of time, and then somehow I was able to peel myself up. It was literally like peeling something out of a glue trap. And at that point, it was gone, and the sun was coming up, and, you know, I just had to sort of pace around and get control of my senses. And at the time, I was certain this was a supernatural experience. Shadow people are some of the more common visions that people see when they experience this stuff. And for my own part, it was, you know, just a very clean, neat silhouette of a person, of a man. No hair, no clothing, kind of a generic silhouette.
Sometimes don't they have red eyes? And then one of the people in your film described shadow men that looked like they were made out of TV static.
And their skin was like television static. You know, it had, you know, like an old TV, when you're not getting a good signal, it had that same kind of texture, that kind of
I saw that as one of the interesting outliers, as sort of what I thought was a unique angle of it, although it connected in sort of a surprising way to a recurrent theme of consumer electronics, people having experiences that involve phones or televisions.
I got up, talking to him, like, hello, hello, and then finally, you know, I walked out into the living room. Just as I got out in the living room, it became, the connection cleared up, and the person on the other end was just like this very pleasant man. He was like, hello, I was wondering if you could do me a favor.
What kind of favor?
Let me in.
I freaked out, you know, I was like, there's a demon on the other end of my phone. I want nothing to do with this. So I threw my phone across the room and it broke into pieces. And then everything around me just like went into complete chaos. It was like almost like an earthquake hit. It's like everything was shaking and dark. And my whole body started vibrating. It felt like something was trying to like rip me out of myself, kind of like pull my soul out.
You know, after a Q&A that we did at a festival, we always do a show of hands of how many people in the audience have experienced something similar, and it is a surprisingly large number. You know, there was one woman who spoke like really dramatically and very emotionally about the ghost of a boyfriend coming out of a TV screen. So it isn't just Poltergeist, The Ring, or in Videodrome.
Yeah, and then there was another really interesting story. One of the women in your film talked about the shadow man eventually being replaced by the spirit of her dead mother.
Yeah, that was a surprise for me, one that I hadn't heard much.
This presence came around, and it came behind me. I was like this. It came behind me, and it hugged me. And I heard the mattress depress also. I heard that depress, like someone went in the bed. And I felt it was my mother. And I heard her voice, and she says, honey, I'm here. I'm here. And it felt so different from that past presence because, you know, this was my mother. It didn't feel evil. It felt warm, and I was happy. And I felt I would talk to her. It's like through my mind, I said, oh, mommy, it's you. Oh, my God, I, you know, and she's hugging me tight, saying, I'm here, I'm here. And that was just a matter of seconds, all of a sudden, that she was gone.
I couldn't help noticing that you didn't include any scientists or doctors or sleep researchers in your film. Why not?
For me, what I find most interesting in this stuff is eyewitness accounts, first-person testimony. You know, I'm much more interested in spending the time that we have talking about people's search for answers than showing a diagram of brain functions or REM states and doing a mediocre job at plumbing the science.
Do we know what causes it?
Well, I mean, there's plenty of science about what's going on in your brain or in your body during these experiences. It seems like it's often linked to being stressed out, having irregular sleep habits. I think it happens more often if you're sleeping on your back rather than sleeping on your side. But trying to get at why people see sometimes similar things, really frightening things, and what they mean. I mean, for me, that's a place where those sorts of questions, I don't know, often the answers seem to be outside of science.
All of the stories were compelling, but I really found Connie Yom's story especially intriguing. Her sleep paralysis experience really had a dramatic impact on her life, didn't it?
Yeah, no, it changed her life. The short version of it is she found religion. She prayed it away.
Then you hear like this sound. It's like, it feels like somebody's screaming right in your ear. Like they're right here and they're screaming. And then I just said, I remember this guy, his name is Jesus, and I'm gonna use his name right now. And I'm gonna say just in Jesus' name, you know, you get out, or said something to that effect.
Jesus' name.
And I suddenly sensed that the demons or the thing that was happening to me, that evil presence, just left, gone. And it was amazing. It was like a feeling of victory.
When they never came back?
They never came back. I wasn't even a Christian then. I actually abhorred religion. Anyways, I learned very late in my life that the name of Jesus has power, and that's how I became a Christian.
Do not believe in the Wikipedia definition of sleep paralysis?
No, that would be sort of like the, I guess the worldly term, like what people would deem as something that's a physiological response, that it's like a natural thing that happens with the body, but I don't think that's true. I do think that it's something to do with the spiritual realm. And it's closely tied with possibly demonic activity.
Also, if you did include some science content, it would have undercut one of the biggest questions, and perhaps even the biggest question that your film raises, which is there something supernatural behind sleep paralysis, or is this just the way our brains work?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to sort of present that dichotomy and let people fight it out. Certainly, that's kind of the big question, you know, that our character at the end of the film is struggling with.
And right behind it, you know, almost like it's like everything's cellophane wrapped or something. And for half a second, that like wrapper's gone. And I could see or perceive something a little bit more real, or whatever real is. And then it's gone. But I can see it for that half a second. And so, like, no matter what fear or pain comes along with it, I always get this experience where, even if it's in my head, it's made something interesting. It's something that I can pull from that makes my life almost kind of worth it, you know, which is, you know, for a long time, something I don't feel like I've ever had. And it's gonna probably just keep getting worse. And I truly believe that one day it will be the reason why, like, one day I don't wake up. And one day I'm just, you know, I don't breathe, I can't control the breathing, and it's done.
Rodney Asher is the director of the documentary The Nightmare. He talked with Doug Gordon. So that's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. If you'd like to subscribe, visit iTunes or Stitcher and search for To the Best of Our Knowledge. This program comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today's hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.